When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Step into a world where ancient wisdom meets modern mysticism. Introducing the Gnostic Tarot, a powerful fusion of esoteric art and Gnostic themes designed for those who seek the ultimate gnosis. This mesmerizing deck, rich in symbolism, draws from the profound teachings of Gnosticism, serving as an ideal companion for meditation, reflection, and the exploration of spiritual realms. Whether you are a seasoned tarot enthusiast or new to the practice, the Gnostic Tarot caters to all, offering a portal to ancient wisdom and a tool for uncovering the hidden truths in your mystical journey. Unveil the mysteries, embrace the wisdom. The Gnostic Tarot is a timeless companion for your spiritual odyssey. Take a journey with Gnostic luminaries and learn their stories in a visually stunning manner. From Sophia to the Gnostic Christ, their journey is your self-discovery. Choose from the basic deck or the deluxe version, which includes a beautifully crafted journey book and a magnetic storage box, ensuring that your Gnostic Tarot remains a treasured companion on your spiritual quest. The Gnostic Tarot is an original and collaborative effort between Miguel Connor of Aeon by Gnostic Radio and Matthew Schmitz of Altrusian Grace Media. Visit our website to embark on your journey today. Syncrasis Publishing, where ancient wisdom and modern mysticism converge.
Welcome, everybody, to Aeon Byte. Welcome to this world where men still have nipples and the center cannot hold, as Yeats spoke in his great poem, The Second Coming, which seems to be more and more true today. Great to see everybody. Great to have you here on this Thursday night. I am Miguel Connor, and I am your Pompidus of Gnosis. That smell of colitas rising up through the air of a world gone mad. But it is good to see you, and I always enjoy your company here in these live shows, on many of the forums, and interacting with you in other places. I always learn something new, and you guys are amazing, and you can all do so many wonders. That is a fact of the universe, because you are here and you are breathing and you are better than what's out there. You are divine light. So very excited today to have a show where we're going to switch chairs. And this time, Graham will go from the seat of the co-host to the throne of the astral guest. Graham, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Miguel. It's always wonderful when you give me a chance to publicly embarrass myself.
Doubt it. I very much doubt it. I mean, people are wondering, what is your secret identity? And I always tell people, well, he's really Dennis DeYoung of Styx. He's always going to make Tommy. It's his vengeance against Tommy for the fight that they had in their band. So that works for people, Graham.
Oh, I was going to say
on my head, on my hand. Sorry.
Oh, absolutely. Paradise Theater was a great album back then.
It is a great album. Yes, indeed. So, Tommy Shaw, that was the great dualistic battle between these two forces. So, but for those of you out there, Graham's going to give us a nice presentation on the origins and evolution of Judaism through Plato and the Second Temple and Herod the Great. And really, for those of you who know your stuff, this will, a lot of it won't be too much of a surprise, because as many scholars have said, including Justin Sledge, the idea of a monolithic Judaism is pretty much a nice fiction that goes along with the other Abrahamic or even Eastern traditions, that there was one stream of any religion. And when we see Judaism as having many, many tributaries and streams, it actually enriches our encounter with this religion and this culture. I mean, Grandma was thinking, even in the first century, I wrote a list of all the different Jewish sects, and this is just first century, start of the Christian era, where Jesus was walking around, and I wrote these sects down. You had the Judeans, you had the Samaritans, you had the Galileans, which some consider sort of the country bumpkins of the culture. You had Hellenistic Jews like Philo of Alexandria, individuals who couldn't even speak Aramaic anymore, purely Greek and purely embracing Plato and the rest of the Greco-Roman culture. You possibly had the Sethian / Ophites. You had the Qumran community, you know, the Dead Sea Scroll cats. You had the Essenes. You had the Therapeutae. Christians in the first century thought of themselves by and large as Jewish. Christianity is a religion. Didn't start till probably the second century. You had the Zealots or Sicarii. You had the Pharisees and you had the Sadducees. So right there is about 12 that I've listed, and I'm sure I'm missing something. So yeah, I mean, Judaism has always been very diverse, right, Graham?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll even throw in the Hypsosarian sort of standing in the doorway listening in.
Right. Yeah.
You know, the non-Jewish ones that kind of like the whole Jewish ideas.
Yeah. The God-fearers. We have to include them in there, too.
Absolutely. And now that's a lot of where my presentation goes into, is some of the origins of those, because the God-fearers were very much influenced by Plato as well.
Very true, yeah. And as Stony Curtis saying, Josephus wrote, the Hyksos were both Jews and Arabs. Yeah, Herod the Great. You had all these people who were, they were kind of Arab, but they were kind of Jewish, so you'd have to include them too.
You know, that brings up the Nabataeans, and they fit into my presentation as well, of course. Yeah.
Ah, cool. Well, let us not tarry. I guess we'll both have to sort of tag team each other if people have want to ask questions or super chat their questions or issues, or if there's an issue, but that's no problem. Vance is still on vacation, or is taking his leave or whatever you want to call it. He's enjoying it, and I'm glad he's doing what he needs to be doing. So for the audience, a little housekeeping as always, please support this show. I can always use your help. Don't forget that in the Red Circle, I have a Red Circle app where you just pay $4.99 a month and you can stream all full shows on your app, and cheap, easy, and on any device you want. I know people have given me good feedback on it. As April ends, we got some great shows coming in May. We will continue the theme of Judaism next week, as we will have a show on the Gnostic Ebionites, who were sort of Jewish Christian Gnostics, if you would, believed to be behind the Gospel of the Hebrews. They thought that Simon Magus and Paul were one and the same. Should be another educational show. We will have a show on Tesla and Egyptian tech, which Graham was a co-host on this one. We will have shows on Gnostic priesthood. Steven Snyder, Recluse, will come to discuss his new book on Stanley Kubrick. So that should be a barn burner. And David Block will come to discuss The Lord of the Rings and more shows. So check it out and don't go anywhere here at the end of the world in these Gnostic times, Philip K. Dick world and Age of Hermes. So, but as I say, enough of my dribble. Let's get started with this. Let's get down to the main event. Where are you? Let's get ourselves. All right. We are in presentation mode, Graham, and just let me when to switch the slides.
Very good. Very good. Thank you, Miguel. And I'm calling this, I'm tracing Judaism from Plato to Herod the Great, and I'm calling it a hypothetical history. Next slide. And many people have asked, you know, kind of what it is I do and how I do it, and I figure I'll break down some of the details here. And I call what I do, basically, it's hypothetical history. And, you know, another term for that could be a speculative counterinterpretation history. It's the idea that the facts are fixed, but the explanations can vary. You know, you don't know which explanation as long as it's consistent with all facts. As long as the explanations are consistent, you can't rule it out. And you rule it out by gathering more facts. And it's a multidisciplinary way of exploring it. It's dealt with a little bit by the mainstream scholars. It's not as accepted by academia. Many more of the hypothetical historians out there, we get, you know, crankpots at worst. Hopefully, independent research is a nice way of looking at it. But this is. Yeah, this is a hypothetical history over, you know, the same facts, but a sort of different explanation of Judaism. Comments, Miguel?
No, rock on. Take us okay. To the other side of midnight.
Absolutely. Let's get rolling. Next slide. You got to deal with.
You got to deal with the names.
I got to be me.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, the first thing we got to deal with is the elephantine in the room, and that's the temple at Elephantine Island in Egypt, and that was one of the longest existing Jewish communities. We have the Elephantine papyri dating from the sixth and fifth centuries BC. But, you know, what emerges from an evaluation of those papyri is something that's very different than the traditional narrative of the Jewish history. This is happening at the same time. It's after Ezra, after the Deuteronomical reforms, and you have them doing things like they have their own temple to Yahweh in Elephantine. And it gets destroyed by the Egyptians during a protest. And then they get authorization from Jerusalem to rebuild that temple. And they have many different sacrifices, including many not authorized in the scriptures. You have priestesses involved in the activity. You have multiple gods being worshipped within the temple, and it's very much a blend between Egyptian and Canaanite traditions, but it shows no sign of having any understanding of a Moses or Aaron or an Exodus. They have records of discussing the Feast of Unleavened Bread, but no mention of a Passover or Moses at all. And this is totally counter the traditional narrative, which has all of those things as having already happened. And the question is how to reconcile all of that. Next slide. At that time, there was, in addition to the temple in Elephantine, you had three other temples that are known to be going. You had the Jerusalem temple. You had the Mount Gerizim temple up in Samaria, and there was also a temple in Edom, and that's why I kind of call it, you know, red temple, blue temple for Edom and Jerusalem, red and blue there. Try to be cute. But later on during the uprising and it part of the Hasmonean Maccabee revolts and everything, you had another temple built on Leonopolis in Egypt, by High Priest Onias. And, you know, so it shows that the whole main Jerusalem temple wasn't as fixed at that time, and definitely not, you know, in the time of the Elephantine papyri. Next slide.
Plato, you gotta say
Plato.
Yeah, like Inspector Clouseau. Plato. Plato.
Plato. Yes. And one of the main concepts that Plato dealt with politically in the Republic was the idea of the noble lie and the idea of creating a synthetic religion, which all of the people could buy into and would thereby bind the society together. It would offer a mythical origin story. It would justify the various social hierarchies. It would promote the civic virtue. It has design sanction. And the rulers would know the truth. And they would use that for controlling the populace and thereby the whole society. And this is the basic core of how Plato saw a religion operating with government. Again, kind of heavy-handed and conspiracy-oriented. But, yeah, the occult Plato. you got the occult Plato in action here. He always liked to keep a little bit behind the belt. Yeah.
And this is in the Republic, right? Or do we find it in other places?
Yeah, it's in the Republic, and he also deals with it some in Laws. There's a lot of parallel between the Republic and Laws with Judaism and the Torah. Next slide.
Well, before I go, how would it be done here in the United States when we allegedly are supposed to have separation of church and state? Or do you just create some myths like, I don't know, George Washington couldn't lie and we were friendly with the natives at Thanksgiving, stuff like that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You created, that's the founding myth of America. The whole, we came over to America in, you know, pursuit of, you know, religious freedom and, you know, all of these, you know, all of these sorts of things. And it's, you know, it's the idea that Plato has it, that essentially in two generations, nobody will ever question the lie. It'll be the only thing that they know. And that's very much what seems to be in play here with the Ptolemies and Judaism.
Ptolemy, of course, we're talking about Alexander the Great's general who took over. He got northern Africa, right? So Egypt.
Yeah.
That was
his fief. Yeah. After the death of Alexander, Ptolemy got Egypt. You had Seleucus ended up with the Persian part. You had the Macedonians. You had a Greek contingent as well. And there were a couple other generals who each had their own following, and that was the whole War of the Successors. But when I say Ptolemies, it's Ptolemy I and especially Ptolemy II, because he was the one who created the kicked the library into high gear, and he authorized the translation of the Septuagint, of the Torah and the Septuagint in 270 BC.
And he also gave us Serapis, the Barry Gibb kind of god, good looking god.
Yeah, with the pot on his head. Yep.
Right.
That's the modus. Yep. That was right, cool. I see that as a Serapis as sort of a mutual synchronization attempt with Alexander and Ptolemy together, because the first reference to Serapis is with the death of Alexander, with the temple of Serapis in Babylon. And the current thought is that's a good idea, that might be Sarapsis.
Right.
and you know, kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke that sort of Ptolemy and Alexander sort of ran with the you know, made it work with Egyptian, with Osiris, and all of that.
Makes sense. All right, let us go to Aristotle.
And Aristotle was the you know, the point counterpoint to Plato, where he was much more, he didn't like a lot of the you know, conniving and behind the scenes behavior. He liked, you know, everything much more upfront, and he was a critic of utopianism. He preferred everything much more nature. It's like in the School of Athens painting by Raphael, where you have Plato pointing up and Aristotle pointing down. Aristotle was always the more grounded of the two. Next slide.
All right. Yeah, and Aristotle. Yeah, I can see an odd couple show with both Plato and Aristotle. Da-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. But I always liked the conspiracy theory that it was Aristotle who had Alexander the Great killed. His pupil got out of control, and, well, something had to be done. But
no, interesting theory. I had not considered that one.
It's hard with Alexander the Great because it's way back then. Huh, well, here we are. Alexander the Great on Plato.
Yeah. I tend to see it as, you know, it goes from Socrates, the philosophy goes Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, then Alexander. And Alexander was very much like philosophy in action. They had built up all these ideas, and then he just sort of took it and put it into the world. And when it comes to him, you know, putting the Plato ideas into effect, he was very much the whole philosopher king ideal that Plato wanted. And he, you know, the whole centralized authority, and very much in the whole education and culture as a means to raise and benefit society. And next slide. You know, and given that Aristotle was its teacher, he's going to be heavily influenced by him. And he liked the idea, you know, he preferred a mixed constitution of government where there were various different levels. And he often allowed conquered cities that surrendered to him pretty much to remain intact. They just switched who they paid their taxes to. And Alexander was very much in emphasizing on practical women, you know, very fundamental, and also big idea in the idea of cultures and syncretism. Next slide. Yeah, and Alexander put his own twist on the thing. He took it to the next level he introduced the idea and incorporated empire building into the Greek ideas. Prior to that, they were very much the idea of city-state, and he was the one who took it to another level of organization above that. And he wasn't just the philosopher, he was also the military leader, and he also managed to establish, through his raw personality and success, a cult upon himself, which was very much capitalized on by the Ptolemies and built upon, where it became the cult of Alexander and the Ptolemies. And they were just sort of kind of butt drafting Alexander at that point. Next slide. Yeah, for Ptolemy 1 and 2, this is where they were building upon the basis of Alexander's. They finished off building Alexandria. They were incorporating many of the ideas that both Plato and Aristotle had incorporated into the Hellenistic pattern, cultural patronage, large urban development, and the integration of the societies in order to become one. Next slide. One of the characters, which is not quite as well studied or known other than you know, his whole Pyrrhic victory epitaph, is Pyrrhus of Epirus. And he was one of the great generals of the ancient world. He was he was the linchpin that kind of linked the Roman and Carthage Western Mediterranean area of conflict with the Eastern Mediterranean Seleucid Ptolemy Greek arena, because he started in the Greek arena and they all ended up what kicked off so many the Punic Wars and so much of the problems was all over Sicily, where you had Rome and Carthage and Greece all fighting over Sicily. And Pyrrhus had become a hostage under the Ptolemies during part of his he had been deposed, became a hostage under the Ptolemies for a while, and probably became very good friends with Ptolemy the son, Ptolemy II. And then the Ptolemy I Soter, he restored Pyrrhus to his throne. Next slide.
Isn't that where we get the term Pyrrhic victory?
Absolutely. No, that's him. Yeah, that's the comment that he made is he, you know, he kept winning victories, and but he kept losing them with so many men by win, you know, in the victory. Right. That he made the comment that he feared if he won one more victory, he'd lose the whole war.
Yeah.
Yeah, I pretty much I'll be breaking down the timeline from Ptolemy to Herod, and I'll try to just only mainly hit the highlights here. And the part of the big point here is the relationship between Pyrrhus and Ptolemy, and how Pyrrhus more or less had become, you know, an ally slash agent of the Ptolemies in waging his wars. And that was sort of how Egypt kept their finger in all of the various different pies going on in the time in the late, and just after the death of Alexander during the wars of the successors. You know, the relationship between the two is Pyrrhus was older, and he had already been a king, and Ptolemy would have been the younger, less experienced, kind of a teenager when he was over there, and they would eventually switch value. And Pyrrhus was a very competent general. They shared the enemies of Cassander, who was one of the Macedonian successors that fought in the war against Seleucid and the others. And Pyrrhus was very much like the hinge between the East and West at that point in time. Next slide. One of the various efforts that Ptolemy II went into, and this was coinciding with the death of Pyrrhus, was the Library of Alexandria. And in some ways, it was a Ptolemaic psyop in that they were trying to control the narrative of the ancient world. They were gathering all the information and then putting the Hellenistic spin on it. That was very much what was happening with when they were getting like Berossus to rewrite the history of Babylon, Manetho to write the history of Egypt. You were getting the new updated versions, but it, like all histories, it was matching what the powers that be needed to have happen, the propaganda, ideological control.
And, so it's kind of like when the internet came about and all these Silicon Valley captains of commerce were like, oh, we're here to democratize the world. But no, they were just giving it their own spin.
Exactly. It's, you know, we'll make copies of all of them. And then, you know, yeah, you can see the ones that we think you should see.
Exactly. They'll be at the top of the search engines.
Those other ones, oh, we don't know what happened to them. They don't exist. Nothing to see here. Move along.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Next slide.
Next slide.
All right. We said Septuagint.
Yep. In 270 was when Septuagint was written in Alexandria. And we have the story of it being a translation of the Torah, which had been written by Moses. And I'm building here upon the work of Russell Gmurkin, who's just, his stuff is just fabulous. And he very much shows that the Torah, which was all that the Septuagint is, was written in Alexandria, roughly 270 BC. And essentially that it wasn't a translation of a Jewish text. It was a co-creation of both the Jewish and the Greek text at the same time, weaving together a lot of older traditions, Egyptian traditions, Ugaritic traditions, Sumerian, Babylon, Assyrian traditions, and they took all of those various threads and then put it through Plato's Noble Eye in order to create this scripture for the synthetic religion. And I list here the various different ways in which the Septuagint can be seen as that creation of the Ptolemies for a synthetic religion and for a synthetic scripture. And this is the case that you can make for the synthetic religion and how the Septuagint fits it. Just not a whole lot to say on this one. We're kind of talking about it. So if there's anything you want to comment on here, Miguel.
Just sort of looking at it. Do you deal with the Masoretic text later on or how does that?
No, the Masoretic tests are well into the ADs. I'm stopping with Herod because I sort of did a beginning and end time for it. It's sort of like, we know what the Second Temple Judaism after Herod did all of his great building constructions were. And that's basically what I'm trying to say is we that's where we're ending. How did we end up at that end point? And I'm starting with the Elephantine papyri and that time period and sort of trying to, you know, weave some sort of tangled route through there that makes sense to me. When, again, it's the hypothetical history that I'm working on here.
Right. Makes sense. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, let's go to Synthetic Judaism 1.
Yeah. Yeah. This is where it's taking all those Canaanite Ugaritic traditions and it's weaving together a synthetic ancient national identity. And it's establishing it's taking Yahweh and using him as the basis for the divine sanction. It's combining Yahweh with Plato's monotheistic absolute, because in a lot of ways, the Greek philosophers like Plato were the ones that, were the first real monotheists. The ones before that were more like henotheists at best. And, by locking in the ancient tradition, you're resisting external influences because you have this ancient book that you can rely on, which may be only a few hundred years, but nobody really knows that except the elites that are creating it, which again is fitting Plato's theories. Next slide.
All right, and part of this give us an identity and some sort of nationalism, ethnicity was bringing in Moses, right? Because I think you said even Gnostic and Orman Neal has talked about how before 500 BC, you don't even hear Moses in any Jewish traditions, like you just mentioned, the Elephantine folks.
Right, right. The first time you have any reference to Moses is under the Ptolemies. It's Hecataeus of Abdera. And he was the one who has the first, you know, version of a Moses story. And it's very different than what ended up in the Torah, because you have Moses. He's also playing the role of Joshua, where he's the conquering general of taking over the Holy Land as well, and other such changes.
Did he have 15 commandments and drop one? I hope he had. I hope he had that version.
I don't know if he had that one. I think that might have had to wait until in for some British guys much later on.
All right, move on.
Move on. And what happened is, with the death of Pyrrhus and just the failure of the whole military aspect that had been going on there, there was a switch under Ptolemy II to more philosophical warfare, which is where the library and the Septuagint fits in. That it's basically, if he can't beat them on the battlefield, he's going to get into their heads and beat them there. Next slide. And Egypt was situated right in between the Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage, and they were involved in the Syrian Wars with the Seleucids. And a lot of times they were kind of having to ping pong back and forth in between the two, negotiating. You know, sometimes they were, you know, they and Rome negotiated treaties. And the whole this period, it was just, it's very convoluted, very complicated. And you have the Punic Wars going on. And at this point in our, my timeline's ending at the end of the First Punic War in 241 BC. Next slide. What happens after the war, in how I see it, and even during the war, throughout the Punic Wars, where you had much of Carthage, especially the elites, were relocating further east in the Mediterranean. Many of them returned to Tyre, their mother city. Many of them went to Egypt, especially Alexandria. And Carthage and Tyre, they were Canaanite religions as well, which is part of the which would help them get tied into the whole Jewish / Septuagint work by the Ptolemies, because very much the Torah, and my take on that is, it's a history of the Semite people. And it's tying them all together. And that's why there's so much of the, beyond just the what we see as traditional Judaism, included in the history of the Bible, in the history within the Bible. And
makes sense.
Yeah, I'm tracking here through the interregnum in between the first and the second Punic War. And one of the big developments there was the rise of Hannibal Barca, who was the great Carthaginian general who took the elephants over the Alps and traipsed through Italy for a dozen years or so.
Right. And I know the Romans didn't like the Carthaginians because of their worship of Moloch. The Romans were many things, but they hated child sacrifice.
Well, they also hated how the Carthaginians were so successful at business.
Yeah, yeah.
The wealth of the Carthaginians was a big sticking point in Rome. Rome just, you know, they thought they should be better at everything than anybody.
Yeah, and they wanted the seas. You had to have that ocean if you wanted to be somebody.
Nope. All right. They were great at appropriation. Next slide.
Yeah, they always have been. All right. Veterans of the First Punic War.
Oh, okay. Let me see. Hold on a sec. I got ahead of you then.
Got a what?
I got ahead of you. I'm running the slideshow on my own so I can read it easier.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I do that too. All right. Well, I've got Veterans of the First Punic
War. I know. I was just one page ahead. I was just one slide ahead. No worries.
All right.
This is very much what I was talking about with the relocating from starting to relocate some of their assets and some of their businesses into safer territory for them, back to Tyre, over to Alexandria. And again, this slide ends with the rise of Hannibal. And throughout all of this, you have the Seleucids and the Ptolemies basically fighting almost constant war. You have the Syrian Wars, which everybody knows about, the Punic Wars, but the Syrian Wars, they had like more of them. I think they had six of them, and it was like constantly going on. So it's like you had the two, East and West were battling it out, and then they ended up going against each other later on, where Julius Caesar took out Egypt, and I guess he won the game of risk at that point.
Yeah.
Next slide. You know, and this is what we're the second one with, Hannibal over the Alps with the elephants. And, you know, and I'm tracking here the relationship between the some of the Western theater with Egypt and with not Egypt and Carthage, Roman and Carthage, and Egypt and the Seleucid Empire in the East, and how they sort of kind of interact with each other, sort of the dance between them all, and how, you know, actions in one impacts the other. Next slide. This is the end of the Second Punic War, where Hannibal gets, basically he gets sold out by his by the Carthage rulers. They basically stop supplying him, stop supporting him, and then call him home, even though he hadn't lost in Italy, because the Romans had basically end run them and landed an army in Carthage and were attacking there. So. And and this one I'm tracking it down up until the up until 205 BC, and getting why I cut off here. But, it's just at the end of the Second Punic War.
Right.
So, next slide. At this point in time, Carthage is pretty much restricted just to a little bit of territory in Africa, and Rome is the dominant Western Mediterranean power. And they're starting to, turn their eyes east and looking at what they can do with the Greeks and the Seleucids and, of course, Egypt. And I'm tracking over here throughout through the end of the Fifth Syrian War, and the whole dance of the whole political intrigues during that time period. Here we have we're looking at the period in the interbellum in between the Second and Third Punic War. And this is where a lot of the remaining people who would have been able to get out of Carthage would have, if you had the resources, because Carthage had been restricted down to basically almost nothing at this point in time. So this is where you had so many of them starting to relocate over back to Canaan and into Egypt and Alexandria. During this time period, you also saw the rise of the Nabataeans, which we had talked about, that Herod the Great was, he was of that. His father was Jewish, but his mother, I think it was his mother who was the Nabatean princess. And because of that, they didn't consider him actually Jewish because his mother wasn't Jewish. He was unlucky Nabatean princess. Again, I don't know why that's a downgrade, but, you know, they saw there. Again, a lot of that had to do with the political intrigues at the time because the idea I have is very much that after the Second Punic War, the Maccabees were basically Carthaginian veterans who decided to take the war to the reclaim their own land, and that they were backed by the Ptolemies in order to fight against the Seleucids, and they were using Ptolemy's the Septuagint and the synthetic religion, and that's where they were basically installing it into the Holy Land using the Maccabees here. And it tied in, part of it was that the Nabataeans, that they're also like the Edomites. And you had a temple in a temple to Yahweh in Nabatea. They would have been part of the whole translation of the Septuagint. And they had their role to play in the creation of this synthetic religion as well. So they were kind of in the know. They were kind of in the know as well. And in many ways, the Nabataeans were sort of like the Phoenicians of the desert. So they were the big trading culture. They were just land based rather than sea based.
That makes sense. Because the Maccabees were they were kind of like the Taliban, but they're also very Hellenistic. They enjoyed their baths and good culture, but they were trying to create a very monolithic, unified Palestine, whatever that region was, recreate Israel, right?
Basically created for the first time.
I guess you're right.
and that's what they're that's the Plato religion, the synthetic religion, is you have this ancient history that everybody believes is true, but didn't actually happen, and you have the synthetic religion, and that's what the Carthaginian veterans, who had basically fled to Tyre and such. It's not that far to move into the Levant within, like I said, the Maccabees, and the Maccabean revolt was very much a Carthaginian veteran, military exercise that was put under the Ptolemaic Septuagint wrapper.
And the Maccabees.
Exactly. The Maccabees are revolting. And the Ptolemies were big, major supporters at the beginning of the Maccabees, as were the Nabataeans. And this was they were both working against the Seleucids. And again, an aside there, my explanation for the death of Alexander the Great, again, I constantly change if I find a better fit. But my current one is that he was poisoned by Ptolemy at direction and in conjunctions with the Nabataeans, because Alexander's had already made plans for his next great military campaign, which was going to be the conquest of Arabia. And Arabia is a place that that's never been conquered. And again, that's the Nabataeans. That was something that could not be allowed to happen. And they saw with the way that Alexander was going that probably was a possibility. So Alexander, that couldn't happen. So Alexander had to go. And Ptolemy was more than happy to do that in order to you know, get Egypt and, you know, set himself up real good.
Makes sense, yeah.
And that's where the Nabataeans played a role again in helping all of the translation of the Septuagint. They would have sent, you know, since they were Yahweh worshippers, some of them were Yahweh worshippers, they would have been, you know, even with the official story, they would have been sending some people over. But they, you know, in this one, I see him more, much more hardcore, hardwired in league with the Ptolemies in the creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense.
But yeah, it's the whole Judah, you know, Judas Maccabee, the whole beginning of the Maccabeans was very much oriented with the Ptolemies and the Nabataeans behind them. And then that switched later on, and we'll get to that in a little bit.
All right.
Next slide. I tend to differentiate between the Maccabees, who were much more, like I said, the Egypt and Nabataean based. The Hasmoneans, they had switched. That's with I think it was Simon. They switched their allegiance much more over to the Seleucids, and became much more of Seleucid agents. Maybe I don't know if it was some really? Seleucids. Yeah, no, there was a switching of allegiance in between Egypt and the Seleucids with the. In the middle of the Maccabees, Hasmoneans, yeah, and that's why I tend to differentiate, you know, draw the line there. But a lot of people just use them synonymously.
Mm-hmm.
Next slide, and that should be 138 BC type of. Yeah, no, during this time period, you had they had already doing the conquer, and that they were now instilling the religion in people. They were forcibly circumcising and converting all the people that they could conquer into the new synthetic religion, the new Judaism they were creating. And in a lot of this, I'm piggybacking on the work of Jonathan Adler, who he showed very much that there was nothing resembling what we know of Second Temple Judaism existing archaeologically until the time of the Maccabees. Mm-hmm. There may have been people, you know, nothing resembling any Torah worshiping, you know, following the laws of Moses. And, you know, that was nowhere to be found in the archaeological record until the time of Maccabees, which, again, is totally consistent with my hypothetical history here of, you know, Judaism being a synthetic religion along the lines that Plato imagined, built on the semi-traditions. And through here, I'm very much tracing, you know, the various ins and outs of the, you know, how the Maccabees ruled from 138 BC until 67 BC, which was the death of Alexander Janaeus. And that was very much like the peak of the Hasmonean dynasty.
Right.
Next slide. Now, Salome Alexandra, who was the wife of Alexander Janaeus, she kept ruling as the queen regent, and her son took over as high priest. And here I'm tracing through the, you know, some of the remainder of the Ptolemy, of the fall of the Hasmoneans. And it ends up with Herod the Great taking over. Next slide. And Herod, he's known for his, you know, he basically put the final facade on Second Temple Judaism by building, you know, Herod's Great Temple, which I've yet to find anywhere in any record just what might have existed on there. We know some temple existed, but nobody really has any speculation of what exists or really where. before Herod built his temple. And he also built Caesarea, and he was just one of the biggest, you know, like with so many of the other Roman leaders at the rulers at the time. He was converting into a city of marble and a city of beauty, what had been something less before that. And he was especially supportive of Judaism, which is funny because, yeah, that they were so rejecting of him. It was very much a love-hate relationship. He wanted to be accepted as Jewish. So he tried to be more Jewish than all of the Jewish people, build a bigger temple, you know, just make it bigger, better. And they just kept rejecting him more and more.
Poor guy. Well, you shouldn't be doing stuff like killing his wife, Maria, and eliminating competition in such a brutal way. So,
yeah, sometimes in that day you had to kill your sons. Yeah, you know, that's just how it worked. Did. Yeah.
I hope the people like me, but I kill my children.
Well, unfortunately for too many of them, it was either kill the children or the children were going to kill them. Bunch of them succeeded because they to the throne because they killed their father. And that pretty much wraps up my presentation.
Lovely. You're right. Yes, we are at the end. That was very cool. I love it. Let's close it down. So we have here, I guess, my question. I don't see any. There's a couple of super chats, but no questions. So if we don't know before Herod the Great or the Maccabeans, what was there? Because, I mean, we do know, obviously, that Cyrus the Great liberated the Jews from Babylon. I still think that the god they imported was Marduk. I think Yahweh got sort of cast aside, and he helped build the second temple. Wasn't there already that, I mean, like all cultures, there was already that priestcraft creation of a state religion, or what do you think happened?
There was a Judaism, for lack of a better term, practiced after Cyrus. Mm-hmm. My take on it is it wasn't Marduk, it was Sin, the moon god.
Yeah, I could see that, yeah.
You know, and that was Sin was basically ended up morphing into Yahweh with a couple of merging with some other deities later on.
Yeah, and I always see Yahweh as this sort of desert demon that the ancient Hebrews called upon, but he got forgotten or left behind or replaced, you know. So with some of the other more like culture friendly right, left brain gods, if you know what I mean. Gods of math, gods of order, gods of obedience, all that stuff.
No, definitely an element there. I see another aspect of it related to the priests of Amun, who would, you know, again, under more directly, I see it, you know, you can go either under Hatshepsut or Akhenaten, where you had a Senemut under Hatshepsut, mm-hmm. who he vanished from the historical record, and it very much tracks to an idea that there had been something resembling an exodus, because he and Hatshepsut, I can't speak tonight. I'm sorry, Miguel.
That's okay. I got you.
Yeah, the two of them got written out of the historical record. Yeah.
Right. I see Daniel Hopkins has showed up for it. If anybody wants to understand the wonderful connection of East and West Buddhism, Semite religions with Persia in the middle, nobody does it better than Daniel to sort of find out the connections and the evolutions and all that good stuff. Because, of course, right, we know that even by that time, you're talking, there were plenty of Eastern influences, right, Graham? Buddhism and all that had reached Alexandria, and of course through the Silk Road.
Oh, absolutely. And even further back, you have, both Plato and Pythagoras, who had been educated in Egypt and Babylon as well. So, you know, they were bringing the Eastern traditions back to Greece, and then, you know, giving them the Greek spin on it there.
Yeah, and it's odd that I think Aristotle is quoted as saying that the Hebrews came from the Hindu Brahmins, which is an interesting quote, right?
It is. Again, Aristotle had things, they had some strange ideas, like number of teeth people have and such.
Really?
Yeah, and I want to say he thought women had two less, I think if it's a teeth, women had to have two, like two less something than men. And it's like, all you had to do was count.
God forbid.
Why count when you can speculate? Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, we hope, as we've talked, that eventually you could give us a good book or a few books on all this very cool alternative history and what's going underneath the hood.
I'm working towards it.
Are you?
I'm working towards it. Yeah. It's so much of it is work in progress, where, you know, it's like changing a tire. You don't tighten down, you know, one lug nut and then go to the next one. You sort of tighten it down a little bit and go on. And yeah, I hate putting out a book that I'm going to have to say, 25% of that I know 2 years later I probably shouldn't have written.
No. Yeah, especially in this day and age, so many new archaeological findings, scholars come with new texts that they've interpreted and all that. So it's fascinating. Best of times, worst of times, right? Because you can never be too sure. Things will change tomorrow.
Absolutely. And on the flip side of that, you have the cultural reaction where, you know, it's bad enough people holding what I actually think against me, you know, the stuff I get wrong, you know, dear Lord.
Dear Lord, yes. Yeah, people want to hold on to their myths. And I always say there's nothing wrong with these myths as long as you see them for what they are. I mean, I think they're beautiful. And they are unifying and they are captivating, but see them what they are. They're, as somebody said, myth is something that never was, but always is. And I think that's very powerful. I mean, let's be realistic. Countries and nations, those are just stories, right? There's no real border to the United States. And most of the government is just a story that's inside our heads that connects us all. And the elite, those that control social engineering, just know how to tap into it for group thought and complete control. But if we can see through those myths, it's both we're liberated, but it's also rewarding. Wouldn't you agree, from a emotional and soul level?
Absolutely. I was going to say, you brought it full circle again, back to Plato and talking about the synthetic religion for people to believe, the elites knowing that, you know, the truth that's otherwise. And it doesn't change unless people wake up.
Exactly. Knowledge is power, but yeah, know how to use that power. Use that power to expand yourself. Find resources for more knowledge. Keep going down the story, one step ahead of these bastards who are destroying our country. Do you think we're in World War III already, or where do you think we're down the line, Graham?
More than likely, we're still in the rumblings of it. As again, they seem to be using the Book of Revelations as some sort of to-do list. So if that's the case, then we don't really have to worry too much about World War III until like 100 million, soldiers start rolling out from the east. Mm-hmm. But again, Lord only knows what sort of nastiness will happen until then.
Yeah, I don't know if they're using the book of the Apocalypse of John. I think they're just profiteering from war, like the other two wars. So All right. Let's see. Super chats. Sophie Bliss, thank you very much for the support. Really appreciate it. We got the man himself, Chester. Thanks, Chester. I had to vent to Chester today, and he was very always there for his friends, and I consider him also a good friend, along with Graham. I greatly appreciate Graham's meticulous research and his unique views. I also appreciate his friendship to AM Bitagnostic Radio. Yes, radio, as you would. Yes, yes. Very cool, and I would agree. So other than that, let me look at the chat. Let me finally look at the chat. I don't see too much of a Chitico. I think everything went pretty well. But again, next week we will focus on the Ebionites, which I find fascinating, second century Gnostic sect. And as I keep saying, if you want to know what the ancient Gnostic stream is, I think it was those who kept the ancient first temple secrets or spiritualities of Asherah and other spirits, and sort of were able to smuggle them underneath the Hasmoneans and all these other groups back when Israel was more of a holistic, shamanistic, just a different animistic religion. And that later on became Gnosticism. Asherah became Sophia, and so forth. I think Margaret Barker makes that argument that she can connect every aeon and archon to an ancient Hebrew spirit. So that's sort of my take, but again, maybe that's a book I need to work on. So any last words, Graham, before they come and take you away? Haha.
Well, it was wonderful as always to be here, and I appreciate you giving me a chance to air my work in progress of some of my hypothetical histories.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's all mine. And do you have something that goes from what you said? I think you said you stopped at Herod the Great. Do you have something that goes forward, or are you still working on that?
Well, I'm still working on that. That's sort of a parallel track to, the two presentations I gave with you on the origins of Christianity, my hypothetical histories there that I was working on there, which right. I didn't Besides, focus.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say I didn't focus much at all on Judea yet, and that was part of where I was going into, and this was research that was leading into that one. And again, that was a work in progress I gave to your Finding Hermes group tag.
Okay, awesome, awesome. Yeah, well, we look forward to the next time you want to show us your presentation, and again, a little bit more on. Like I said, Jewish Christianity next week with the Ebionites, also a show on Tesla and ancient Egyptian tech. So it all kind of ties in together and it all will make sense and hopefully lighten the way for your own personal gnosis. So everybody in the chat or is here live, thank you for being here. And if you're listening to the replay, I hope you found this as educational and enlightening as I have. And Graham, as always, thanks for coming on the show, whether you're a guest or a co-host.
Oh, it's always wonderful. And I look forward to all the times I get to do it in the future. Thanks again.
Rock on, man. Well, for everybody else, please have a good rest of your evening. Have a good evening. And as I always say, write your own gospel, live your own myth, or some philosopher king is going to do it for you, based on the Republic. All right. Good night, everybody. And thank you.